because his last name is Woodhouse, and how he now lives in Dix Hills on Daly Road. I'm guessing his email, his information is going to be on QRZ.com, I'm guessing. And if you have trouble getting a hold of Woody, K2UU, give me an email or a call or whatever, John. I can get you his phone number. Arguably, he is the best ham radio antenna installer on the East Coast of the United States because he's done so darn many of them. Everything from extremely simple installations to, let me drop. Quite a few guys will pool all of their money as they approach retirement age, and they say to Woody, hey, I've been dreaming about this rock crusher of an antenna for the last 20 years. I now can afford it, and it's going to require a pair of Rhone 55 towers, a 1 foot high, side by side, one acting as a chin pole for the other one so that the hold-on thing can be tilted over to the ground so that I can now put on my VHF antennas and hold this thing back up without all the problems of a crank-up tower, with all the problems of the coax cable not being, a hard line not being well attached all the way. And oh, by the way, I want that antenna to be fully, I want the whole damn tower to be fully rotatable. You give that kind of a crazy requirement to Woody, K2UU. He says, yeah, it'll take 2 weeks. It'll take 2 weeks to put it up. It'll take me another couple of weeks to gather all the hardware and properly machine it to do what you want. So he's got it. So I think that's the man you're looking for, John. KD2IXP, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Sounds like an excellent recommendation. Just two quick comments. Earlier, this gentleman was discussing listening to his own audio output. When I worked for Vermont Public Radio, we had an engineer there, Jerry Erickson, who was W1FRE. And he's the one who got me interested in ham. Unfortunately, Jerry's a silent key now. But he had the stations set up. We had a Harris 25K transmitter into a four-bay antenna on top of Mount Escutney with a microwave link from the top of Mount Escutney to the station, the studio. And right next to the link in the cabinet was a Marantz receiver, and we never listened to what was going out. We monitored what was coming in, but again, this was pure FM. Makes a difference.
It sure does, John. The magic of FM, that it can tolerate tremendous amounts of limiting, overloading in whatever stages. As long as the stage doesn't become thoroughly blocked, as long as some little signal will leak through that heavily overloaded stage, it still is swishing up and down in frequency with the FM modulation. The discriminator and limiter will look at that and say, hey, there's beautiful audio. That's the magic of FM. Each has its advantages. Sideband has at least 10, maybe 20 dB of more sensitivity. An extremely weak single sideband signal of a very small fraction of a microvolt can give you a 95% audio intelligibility in very noisy conditions. In the case of FM, if you don't have close to 10 decibels of positive carrier-to-noise ratio, you're going to have a pretty noisy-sounding signal, and it's got a really nasty crashing effect. As you approach that threshold, 1 dB of difference will make you go between a 10 dB signal-to-noise ratio and something that's almost unlistenable. Sideband is linear all the way down. And so each has its advantages. Sideband has tremendous range capability, but it's a much more difficult transmitter to make thoroughly linear in every one of its stages. You peak and below power output without flat topping, without crossover distortion, without intermodulation distortion, all the other things that can go on with it. But if you pay the price, boy, does that signal get through. Let me drop. When you go to that website called Mike Number Two's website, and that's the one that's called TechNetLimon.com, and you look at that picture of that array of 16 Yagis with me standing in the middle of it on 432 megacycles. That was 16 foot wide, 15 and a half foot high, 13 feet deep. that queue of antennas, 3,500 cubic feet of antenna mounted on the top of 100 foot of tower at my location in Huntington, where I am right now. That, with a kilowatt transmitter, would allow me to talk 480 miles on sideband to K4CAW in Greensboro, North Carolina. I talked to him when he and I first met each other. We were amazed the signal got that far with no good open band conditions. So we decided to, hey, this is Tuesday, let's meet again next Tuesday, 7:30 to 8 o'clock. We did that for 4.5 years. And every one of those days, the signal got through, summer, winter, spring, and fall. Who the hell would ever believe that where my radio horizon is 40 miles away, and he's 480 miles from me, North Carolina, 200 miles inland, over a primarily overland path. Not very much of that is over water. We never would have believed it. Let me drop it. And lots of guys up here near me said, hey, this is phony. I don't hear the other guy on the other end. You guys are on the telephone making a false contact. And the people near him were saying the same thing. Eventually, there's some guys midway between in Maryland, on top of mountains, would flip their antennas back and forth and say, hey, these guys are really doing it. I'm hearing both ends. On top of that, half-hour QSO every Tuesday night for 4.5 years. Can you imagine the phone bill we would have run up if that wasn't real? But still, we had some very, very well-respected guys accusing us of it being a phony signal. If you didn't have a big enough capture area of your antenna, you didn't hear that signal. What that taught us, you build a big enough antenna, put enough power into it, what is the range distance, what's the range maximum you can get? 480 miles, we did it easily. And I eventually discovered that the extra water that was crawling into my foam cables, my FM8 cables that were the phasing harness, was giving me a couple of extra dB of loss. I was losing a couple of dB of potential noise figure right in my own phasing harness because of the cables I had chosen to use over those years. And I have reason to believe with that kind of equipment, once in a while, I'd be able to talk to a guy, even without a band opening, to plow it 1,200 miles, if you know what I mean, because it's a primarily overwater path. So if somebody ever asks you, let me drop. So if somebody asks you, how far can a radio signal go? There is no answer. It's just a matter of the right conditions, the right transmitting equipment, the right receiving equipment, the right antennas, low enough noise figures, the right bandwidth, the right demodulation techniques. How far can a radio signal go? The answer is almost forever. That Voyager spacecraft moving away from us at 40,000 miles an hour, we're going to listen to it for the next 10 years, maybe longer, as it reports back to us what it sees out there. There ain't no limit. Just a matter of using the right equipment, and you will not run into a limit if you're smart enough. Okay, let's see, K2X, we got you.
Somebody took a bite out of the moon.
Okay, somebody took a bite out of the moon. It's starting to happen. Jose, N2, Triple Delta. Very nice picture of you on your QRZ website. Nice equipment, nice picture of your shack. Go right ahead with your question with impedance matching, Jose. N2, Triple Delta. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, enter DDD. Yeah, so my question was about matching. Sometimes I get confused with, you know, you have a dipole and you have the line on one side and the other part of the cable is the ground. You have a vertical antenna that we have the load on it, and the ground, we try to make out the ground with some radios or anything. In the car, we try to make out the ground. We don't actually cast and all that stuff. But then how does that affect the matching? I see some of the four-band antennas that come in, and others have, I tell you specifically where to put it, because if you don't put it there, you cannot match it. So I don't exactly understand why is that.
Yeah, I can see what you're asking, Roger. And it's a good question. That's not well explained in any of the books. Let's start off with the basics. Most of the transmitters you and I can buy and use are made for 50 ohm output. That really means the transmitter wants to think it sees a 50-ohm resistor. Your transmission line, which maybe is 50-ohm coax cable, if it has the right load on the far end, the input end of it at the transmitter will look like 50 ohms, and the transmitter will give you full performance. For your antenna to look like a 50-ohm resistor, there you got to do some work. If I take a well-designed dipole in free space, and if it's exactly a half wavelength long electronically, and nothing else is nearby, and I'm feeding it just right with the right kind of a balancing structure, it represents a 73-ohm resistor, and the 73-ohm load on the 50-ohm cable is a 1.3 standing wave ratio. Quite good. Don't worry about it. Don't lose any sleep over that. However, take that dipole and build half of a dipole, which you and I call a ground plane. In other words, I can put a sheet of metal right down the middle of the dipole at right angles to it. And when I put that sheet of metal there, because at one instant of time, the right side of the dipole is positive, the next side is negative, and then the other half cycle, they reverse, there's a neutral plane in the middle. There's no voltage in the middle, per se. I can put that sheet of metal there, and nothing changes. And therefore, I can decide to throw away the left-hand side. Let me drop. And use just the right-hand side of the dipole with that sheet of metal. And you and I call that a ground plane antenna. If I put that ground plane antenna on my automobile, where the sheet of metal that it uses as the ground plane is not a nice flat sheet of metal that goes out to infinity, it maybe is the hood of my car, the fender of my car, the bumper of my car. It's got a different shape. If I put other things nearby and construct it in other ways, add doodads to it so that it works on multiple bands, there's a zillion ways that you can change the antenna such that at first, not a pure resistor anymore. If the antenna is tuned a little bit too high in frequency, it'll give you what we call inductive reactance. If it's tuned too low in frequency, it'll give you what we call capacitive reactance. Let me reverse that. If I feed it a frequency that's too low, it'll look like a capacitor. If I feed it a frequency that's too high, it'll look like an inductor. By way of the right kind of measuring equipment, if you've got a standing wave ratio detector, let me drop. If you've got a standing wave detector, if you've got a bird watt meter and you measure the amount of power going forward and the amount of power going reverse, you know, one of the things I didn't tell you is that a piece of 50-ohm cable with an antenna on the end that's perfect, so to speak, it acts like a 50-ohm resistor. All of the power coming out of your transmitter goes down that transmission line once. All of it gets absorbed by the antenna. None of it comes back. Make any change in that antenna such that it's not 50 ohms anymore. Maybe it's 40 ohms, maybe it's 70 ohms. Make any change to make the antenna tuned a little bit high or a little bit low, where now it's too capacitive or too inductive. You make any of those changes, and a given amount of power you send to the antenna will not be absorbed by the antenna, gets reflected back to the transmitter, shows up as what we call standing wave ratio. Your bird watt meter will say 30 watts is going forward and 15 watts is coming back. That's not good. That's a fairly high standing wave ratio. So unless you make the antenna a nearly pure resistor at nearly 50 ohms, you're going to get some reflected power. The transmitter is going to complain. It's not going to transmit as well in the space that you want. With the right kind of equipment, you beg and borrow or buy an antenna analyzer, a bird directional watt meter. You use any of these pieces of equipment, you'll find out whether or not your antenna in your particular environment, your particular installation, on your exact automobile, is it acting like a resistor? By way of you using the bird watt meter, the antenna analyzer, the standing wave ratio bridge, you'll get an answer right away. And if you use the piece of equipment correctly, it's like a blind man standing on the side of a hill. The tilt of his shoes tells him which way is uphill.
Repeater, time out.
By way of that antenna analyzer, that standing wave ratio bridge, that bird watt meter, looking at forward and reverse power, you will find out, in general, which direction is right or wrong. You're going to make the antenna a little bit longer, a little bit shorter. You can take a piece of copper tape or aluminum tape and tape a little flag to the top of the whip of the antenna. That that adds capacitance to the tip of the antenna and brings it to a lower frequency. Do that experiment. Add a little piece of metal to the top of the antenna, and if the standing wave ratio gets better, goes to a lower number, you say, hey, I'm going in the right direction. Let's keep doing that. If it gets worse, you know that that's the wrong direction. The antenna's already a little bit too long. Maybe you've got to cut off some length, and so on. There's various ways of taking any terrible-looking installation. There are ways of making an antenna look ugly as all hell, really bad installation, rusty installations, improper grounding, lousy transmission lines, and whatever. If you do the step-by-step measurement and tuning procedure, the homeliest-looking antenna can be made to work like a charm. Those RF waves don't look at the beauty of your antenna, how shiny it is, and whether or not it's big enough, if you know what I mean. There are ways of electronically forcing that antenna to be a good impedance match to your cable and your transmitter. So no matter how bad the situation is, it is very correctable. Let me drop it. The next step for you, Jose, is to what I call divide and conquer. Right now, you're frustrated because the antenna is not working well, and you've got a number of suspicions of what's doing it. With the right kind of instrumentation, which you're going to buy, borrow, steal, have somebody come over and give you a measurement, or you go to the antenna, you go to the clinic. By that I mean every Limark event, every time there's a flea market at Limark, there's a guy there named Andy, WA2CDL, with his tuned-up equipment. He's got his power supply, his service monitor, his spectrum analyzer, his bird watt meter, his dummy loads. He's got all the equipment to take your portable piece of equipment, your tabletop equipment and whatever, and tell you, is it working correctly? Should it be tuned differently? And if you can talk him to walk out to your car and make a measurement on your particular mobile installation, he'll tell you it's tuned high, it's tuned low, the impedance is too high, too low, the resistive component has to be changed, takes a little bit more adjustment, and so on. No matter how bad it is almost always correctable. Just a matter of you bringing the right resources to the problem. Now that you know you're going to do what I call divide and conquer, don't give up. Where you are right now, Jose, we have all been there at one time. It's an educational process. You're allowed to ask as many questions as you like. You're allowed to come back next week and the week after and re-ask this question if you don't get enough information. November 2, Triple Delta, K2IW and TechNet. You got it, Jose.
So, if I understand correctly, basically it's impossible to have an antenna that is 1-to-1 and a 50 ohm. Is that correct? Because, when I was doing the testing on some of my antennas, I can bring them out to the SWR that I like, but I never see it on a 50 ohm. It's either I get it onto that SWR and it's a 42 ohm or a 55 or a 60 or something like that. Back to you.
Okay. No one has given you the right information, Jose, as to where is the ballpark and where is home plate. If your antenna is tuned correctly so that most of the reactance has gone away, and now you're left with a resistive component of 42 ohms, you are there. You're well inside the ballpark. You're somewhere between the pitcher's mound and home plate. 42 ohm resistive component with no reactance is about a 1.3 standing wave ratio. Anything better than 1.5 is academic. You don't have to be that much better, if you know what I mean. Lots of guys think that it's got to be exactly 50 ohms. It's not that exact. The RF energy is not that persnickety. So if you're within 30 ohms to 70 ohms, the resistive component is almost good enough. Go to 50 if you can get it. But if the best you can do is 42, you are there. Any reasonable transmitter with 42 ohm resistive component and no reactive component will keep right on cranking and work like a charm. So somebody has given you too stiff a criteria. You probably thought you had to get 50 ohms plus or minus half an ohm. It's nowhere near that exact is the requirement. So you have to get into the middle of the ballpark, if you know what I mean. It doesn't have to be at home plate all the time. Over to you, Jose. N2 Triple Delta, K2RIW in the TechNet. And by the way, if at some later time you wanted to really be an exacting guy, you're enough of a scientist, with some more elaborate tuning techniques, you can make the resistor component 50 ohms. I didn't say it's easy, but 42 ohms is good enough. Over to you, Jose, K2LIW.
Can we get an unrelated comment?
Yeah, let Jose respond first, and then I'll get to you, Joe.
K2LIW, and I keep on experimenting. I think I appreciate the comments. With that, I will be able to not just scratch my head anymore. it's especially when we're doing portable. I got like a body stick and all that stuff. And obviously, it doesn't have a ground plane or anything like that, but it has the ground wire that you put in. It obviously affects the reactance of it, but it's just like, I was told it's 1-to-1. Awesome. Thank you so much, and I'll pass it on to that one with the comments. And to DC, I'll be listening, and thank you.
Yeah, very fine, Jose. Don't give up. You're in the middle of a learning curve. A lot of us have been there. It's a bit confusing in the beginning. But what is good enough is part of what you're learning. It doesn't have to be perfect right off the bat. And if you want to be a scientist, there are ways of making it perfect. You'll have to be working a little bit harder to do it. So when it comes to tuning an antenna, there's a zillion ways to tune an antenna. And they're not taught very well in the books. They're not taught very well in the classes that you take. The guys who have been in the antenna tuning business for a while, the ham radio operators, they've learned a whole bunch of tricks. A whole bunch of rules of thumb, if you know what I mean. And 42 ohms is one of the rules of thumb, is good enough. Almost every transmitter will be happy at 42 ohms, with rare exception. And one of the guys who's been down this road is Joe, WJ2B. Get right here with your comment, Joe. K2RIW in the TechNet. I bet you were a little bit confused the very first time you tried to do an antenna. At least I was. You got it, Joe.
Okay, WJ2B. Yeah, I agree that those antenna analyzers are a little, give you too much information. Really, all you care about really is SWR. And, try to tune out the reactive component and get the resistive component down to 50 ohms is usually very difficult with today's antennas. They're not all designed that well that you can get them to read exactly 50 ohms. But actually, my unrelated comment was the lunar eclipse is in partial right now. It's about a quarter eclipsed. The cloud cover all broke up, so you can see it's very clear. The moon's very bright. And the total eclipse starts at 10:11, and it centers at 10:47. So the blood red moon at fully eclipsed is going to occur at 10:47, but it's very visible right now. The moon's about a quarter eclipsed right now with no cloud cover at all. WJ2B.
Very fine, Joe. Joe, you're looking at the moon right now. Give me a very rough guess. How many degrees above the horizon? And is it halfway between the east and south, so to speak? Over to you, Joe.
I was out about 15 minutes ago. It was, I'd say, about 30 degrees above the horizon, southeast direction, and it was fully visible, no cloud cover. And it should be a really good good night for viewing it tonight. Originally, they said it was going to be very cloudy, but they were incorrect. All the cloud cover has broken up, WJ2B.
Looks great, and that's the Glenn 2ABG. Now, that was Dave in 2APG, so he's getting a good view in Massapequa. John's getting a good view in Staten Island. Joe's getting a good view out there in the Stony Brook area. So, looks like the moon is there. It's good to look at it. And this is one of those events that, exactly in this form, is not going to be repeated for a zillion years, if you know what I mean. So, maybe you want to go look at it. Okay, I think we've gone down the list of everybody who asked us a question. Time to go over to the mailbag. And, John, have you gotten any exciting technical questions from these guys that like to win that prize because they stump us? Get ready, John. KC2WGB with the mailbag. K2RIW in the second half.
KC2WGB, London Letter Reading Tech. You mean Tech Paul from on the net? Yep. Got an interesting question here. Young gentleman questioning inductance. Let me let her drop and I'll give you the question. Okay, he's examining a piece of wire. It's approximately 10 inches long. And he says, okay, we'll assume it has 1 microhenry per inch. Now he says 10 inches long. We're going to draw it through equally, make it 20 inches long. What happens to the inductive component? Does it change, and how does it change? Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, his 1 microhenry per inch is an extremely high number. That's a wag, a wild-ass guess, and it didn't work. The rough rule of thumb used by VHF, UHF guys who tune circuits, where they typically use something like a piece of 18-gauge wire to go from point A to point B, and it typically is, let me pick a number, an eighth of an inch over the ground plane, so to speak. Under those conditions, each piece of wire you use has approximately, very round numbers, 22 nanohenries per inch. Let me repeat that. Approximately 22 nanohenries per inch is the rough approximation for the average size wire that you wire a circuit with the average way you do it. If that wire was completely straight out in free space, the amount of inductance, I think, would be a little bit higher because the magnetic field is not being shielded. The current flowing through the wire is similar to you wrapping your fingers over the wire and your thumb is in the direction of the wire. If the current flow through the wire follows your thumb, your fingers wrap around the wire, show you where the magnetic field outside the wire wants to go. It's a completely curved, completely closed circles of magnetic field around your wire because current is flowing through it. Let me drop. And as you bring that parallel piece of wire down to a ground plane, you're starting to shield some of that magnetic field. You're starting to create an interruption where the magnetic field doesn't form as easily. Therefore, as you bring that wire closer and closer to the ground plane, you'll get less than 22 nanohenries per inch. Now, if you do the opposite, if you put a toroid of a magnetic material over the piece of wire, because the toroid is made out of material where the magnetic field will flow through it 10, 100, or 1,000 times easier than it flows through air. Let me choose the number 100. If I slip one or two of these tiny little toroid RF choke-like things over the wire and assume that I'm using material that has a view of 100, that's a fancy way of saying the magnetic field will flow through that toroid material 100 times easier than it will through air, then for that particular length where the toroid exists, it's not 22 nanohenries per inch. It's 100 times higher than that because you've added something to the outside of the wire so that that magnetic field that wants to form around the wire is now a lot easier for it to do it. Therefore, you get higher inductance. Inductance is a little bit crazy, as you can tell. The amount of current you put into an inductor stores energy, very similar to compressing a spring. And by the way you wind an inductor, quite often it looks like a spring. Let me drop. If I take a spring and push on it so that I'm compressing it, coiled spring, I've got stored mechanical energy. And as I now release the pressure on the spring, it gives the energy back to me. I may not really be using it, but I could use it to, I could compress that spring, put it behind my little toy automobile, between the wall and the toy automobile, and let go. And now that stored energy is going to push the toy automobile, at a pretty high rate of speed across the floor. Stored energy. When you put current into an inductor, by the magnetic field that forms in the inductor, it's a little bit like compressing a spring. To put more and more current, to put more and more stored energy in the inductor, you have to put in more and more current. It's equivalent to pushing hotter and hotter in the spring to compress it harder and harder. And when you remove that current-generating device, the inductive kickback from that inductor is where it's giving you that energy back again. And so each length of wire has a defined amount of inductance, and there's a catch to that. You keep saying, I'm going to make the wire longer and longer, and the inductance is going to get higher and higher. That's sort of true, but there's a catch. Let me drop. If you're doing it with a DC circuit, it will behave pretty much the way we discussed. Depending on how you lay out the wire, and you figure out that it's above or below 22 nanohenries per inch for your particular layout of wire, and now you add more and more inches, will you be multiplying that number of inches by 22 nanohenry? Very much so. That's if you're putting DC current into that. If you're now putting an AC signal into it, 1 megacycle, for instance, eventually you get to the point, or maybe 100 megacycles, you get to the point where the wire starts approaching a quarter wavelength or so. All of a sudden now you're getting other antenna effects. The signal bouncing back and forth in that wire is a little bit similar to the way the current bounces back and forth in a monopole or a dipole. Now the inductance is not so clear. Now you're getting into what's called the Brown and Woodward curves. By that I mean, you go to either of those websites and you look up the article by K2LIW about getting perfect impedance match to a dipole. Or you look at Chapter 4 of almost any issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and you'll see a set of curves. And those set of curves will tell you that for a wire of this diameter and a wire for this particular length, let me drop it. This particular length at this frequency, and they define the length as a number of degrees. If you've made the wire at your particular operating frequency a quarter wavelength long, full wavelength they call it 360 degrees, quarter wavelength they call it 90 degrees. So you look at the curve where the horizontal axis is 90 degrees, and then one of those graphs will show you the resistive component for that length of wire of that diameter. The other curve will tell you the reactive component, whether or not it's inductive or capacitive, and how many ohms of inductive or capacitive reactance you're going to get for that length of wire, that many degrees of wire at that operating frequency. Mr. Brown and Woodward, way back in 1945, spent a man-year of their life, in my opinion, with old-fashioned equipment, a signal generator, a frequency meter, a slotted line, and a slide rule. And they made a zillion measurements, and each measurement probably took them 10 minutes, and that gave them one dot on that curve. And you probably need 100 or 500 dots in order to draw one of those curves, and the graph contains about 30 curves. That's why I say each one of those graphs, all those graphs together, probably took them a man year. But what's magic about that data is it's real. It's not somebody's harebrained theory of operation with a bunch of derived equations that give you a ballpark number that works some of the time. That's real data. You take your length of wire of your diameter at your frequency, and you go to that curve, and there is the exact impedance that's going to give you as an antenna. And if you now start putting shielding equipment around it, you'll get a different result. And we'll go into that someday. But, in other words,
repeater, timeout.
So the bottom line of all that is that as the antenna, as a piece of wire, starts approaching a quarter wavelength in length at your particular operating frequency, it's not a simple inductor anymore. It's now becoming an antenna that's got a resistive component and a reactive component of its radiation impedance that you're going to see as you feed a signal into that wire. So, inductors store energy. If you know how much current you're putting into an inductor, and you know how many Henrys it has, the formula is 1/2 Li². Take the inductance and square it, multiply it by the inductance, take the current in amperes and square it, take the inductance in Henrys, multiply the two together and divide by two. That tells you the number of stored joules of energy. A joule of energy is a newton meter, it's a watt second. 1 joule is a watt second, or it's a newton meter. So once you by various techniques measure or calculate accurately the inductance of your wire and how much current is flowing through it and how much stored energy it has, and now you know what it will do if you let go of it like a spring, so to speak. And whenever you put current into an inductor and let go of it, it's going to come back to you in a hurry. You'll learn that lesson very quickly if you decide to take an ordinary 60-cycle power transformer. Let me drop. And you decide you want to measure the resistance of the primary winding. Set your ohm meter to the lowest scale, the times one scale. Take the two probes of the ohm meter. You put it across the two wires of the transformer. You hold the probes of the ohm meter against the wires with your fingers, left-hand probe, left-hand wire, left-hand index finger and thumb, and the same thing on the right-hand side. And pretty soon the ohm meter settles down, and you might measure 7 ohms, primary inductance. Okay, the test is over. You're about to disconnect that probe from the transformer. And all of a sudden, you're going to yell, wow. At the instant you disconnect the ohmmeter, which was pouring current into the primary winding of that transformer, and it was storing magnetic energy in its core, because that core has got, in some cases, a couple of Henry of inductance. And when that probe becomes disconnected from that primary, and you get the inductive kickback, which in many cases is a couple of thousand volts, very briefly, only does it for a millisecond, not going to electrocute you, but it's going to make you uncomfortable, and you're probably going to shout out. The first time you do that, you say, wow, what happened? That's a beautiful example of stored energy, 1/2 Li squared, joules of energy, and when your current is no longer flowing, and one of the universal laws of electronics is you cannot instantaneously change the current flowing through an inductor. By you going from the probe of your ohmmeter connected, instantaneously disconnected it, you instantaneously tried to make the current, which was some number of milliamperes, suddenly go to zero, and the inductor is going to say, I'm not going to let you do that. He's going to take all of that stored energy and give it back to you immediately as one great big spike of voltage, and you're going to holler.
Repeater, time out.
I wonder if that has ever happened to you, John. It has only happened to me about 10 times in my life. KC2WGB, KQRIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yeah, I wish it only happened 10 times in my lifetime. I think I make that mistake every time I do it. Yeah, it depends on where your finger is at the time. Well, let me rephrase the question. Maybe you didn't understand completely. That covered a lot of it. But his question was actually, if he had a certain gauge wire and it was 10 inches long, okay, 22 nanometers. Now, if we drew it through a die, we elongate the wire. Now we're making it longer, but its diameter is shrinking. That was his question. What happens to the inductance per millimeter or per inch or however you want to do that? And let's assume we're talking about the DC. We won't get into the complications of the quarter wavelength.
Another darn good question, John. If I started off with a piece of 18-gauge wire and I repeated the experiment with a 14-gauge piece of wire, or I started off with a piece of 14-gauge wire, measured the inductance, now put it through a die and made it longer. You'll find out that within reason, the amount of inductance per inch, nanohenries per inch, changes very slowly with diameter. If I halved the diameter of the wire, instead of 22 nanohenries per inch, I'm going to make a guess, I'm going to get 24 or 25 nanohenries per inch. I've halved the diameter of the wire. Common sense would lead you to believe I've doubled the inductance per inch. Absolutely not. Length does most of it. The way the magnetic field lines want to wrap around that wire can do it very easily, whether that wire is 22 gauge, 18 gauge, or 14 gauge. Once you start making that so-called piece of wire a 1-inch diameter copper rod, now you've made a big difference. Because an awful lot of those lines were previously spaced around that wire, starting off at 128th of an inch away from the wire, and going out for maybe a half inch around that wire, is where the majority of the magnetic lines of force were when it was a skinny piece of wire. And you make the wire skinnier yet, you added a little bit of extra area down near the bottom, if you know what I mean, but not much has happened. You suddenly make that piece of wire 1 inch in diameter. Now you've taken up a lot of that space where those magnetic lines of force want to form, and now the 22 nanohenries per inch might go down to 3 nanohenries per inch, if you know what I mean. You've made a huge change, orders of magnitude. But stretching out the wire with a die, it'll change, but rather slowly.
Repeater, time out.
So in general, the amount of inductance you get is primarily a matter of length. Not very much a matter of diameter. Length is all of it. And Now you start wrapping it into turns of a solenoid coil, where if you do it just right, the majority of the magnetic lines of force link every one of those turns. All of a sudden, the inductance goes up almost square law with turns. You wind the coil tight enough along the length. In other words, the spacing is only the spacing of the enamel of the wire, so to speak, no air spacing in there, and reasonable diameter of the coil. It goes up very close to n squared. You double the number of turns, and you've got four times the amount of inductance, if you know what I mean. So length and turns dominates. Diameter is a second order effect. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. That gave me some information, too, because I've never really used my Gauss meter and examined the field on a wire that was maybe, say, a foot long and 22 gauge versus maybe like 14 gauge. I never examined those fields, so I really didn't know which was going to have the greater effect. But that was a good question. I love those questions. All right, let me let it drop. I'll go on to the next one. Okay, I have an amateur here who believes he understands basically induction and how transformer cores work and when they're wound and the coupling that is involved. What his question is, how do Hall effect units work? He has a probe that has two little ferrite beads that clip onto a wire, and he wants to know, how does it know the current? How does the Hall effect unit work? What is it made up of? And what is it actually doing? That's what he's wondering. So maybe you can help him out with that, Dick. KC2WGB. Back to you.
Yeah, what I did a couple of hours ago is I Googled the word Hall effect. Wikipedia and a few other sites have got a medium good explanation of Hall effect. I'm going to give you my version of it. The so-called Lorentz force. If you took a cathode ray tube, you've probably seen YouTube videos along this line, where you've got a high vacuum in a long glass clear tube. You've got a cathode assembly at one end with a heated cathode and some negative voltage on it. And way down at the other end, you've got a phosphor screen with a great big positive voltage on it. Maybe there's some accelerating anodes along the way. But you've created a stream of electrons going across that cathode ray tube. And by various techniques, you can make visualization of that stream of electrons. There's a couple of YouTube videos that'll show you that. So here you've got the stream of electrons going through the middle of that cathode ray tube, and now you bring a magnet nearby, and you're going to experience the Lorentz effect. If I took my right hand, and if I use my thumb, index finger, and middle finger, and I make my thumb go straight up, my index finger goes straight out, and my middle finger, I bend it at 90 degrees right at the end of the palm of my hand. So I've got these three fingers at right angles to each other. That really is an XYZ cardinal, what do they call it now? A way of graphing things, if you know what I mean, an XYZ coordinate system. It's got another name I can't think of. If one of those fingers represents, let me drop it. That's it, the Cartesian coordinate system. One of those fingers represents the direction of current flow of charged particles. Another finger represents the direction of the magnetic field, north to south, so to speak. The third finger will tell you which is the direction of the force. The bottom line of this is that I put my magnet nearby of this cathode ray tube, and I will see that stream of electrons bend away from the magnet at right angles to the magnetic field. That's the Lorentz force, following this three-finger right-hand rule, if you know what I mean. And so moving charge through a magnetic field creates this force that bends the beam. Okay, once you accept that with a cathode ray tube, now you start off with the right kind of semiconductor material. And they've used quite a few different kinds of crystals and whatever. But you start off with a semiconductor material. Let me drop. For simplicity, I'm going to make it a square. But if you want maximum sensitivity, there are other form factors that work a little bit better. But I've got the square. And I've got a probe on each one of the four sides of the square. One probe at the top, I'm going to call that 12 o'clock. One probe at the bottom, I'm going to call it 6 o'clock. And I've got two other probes at 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock. I'm going to apply some current. I'm going to put some voltage between the 12 o'clock position and the 6 o'clock position. So in my semiconductor material, I've got electrons flowing from 12 o'clock to 6 o'clock. And now I'm going to put a very sensitive voltmeter between the 3 o'clock and the 9 o'clock position. Under normal conditions, the potential difference between 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock is 0 volts. When I've made this symmetric square and I'm applying current between 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock. Now I put a magnetic field at right angle to this thin piece of material that made the square. In other words, I'm looking at the thing's top view the way I described it to you, and I'm now going to make the magnetic field go either into it or out of it, so to speak. That, by the Lorentz force, is going to take those electrons going from 12 o'clock toward 6 o'clock, and it's going to bend them to the right or to the left, depending on the polarity and magnitude of the magnetic field. Let me drop. When the Lorentz force bends that stream of electrons, and they get down toward 6 o'clock, but they arrive a little bit right of center or left of center, if you know what I mean, that creates a potential difference between those two probes at 3 o'clock and 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock. And now the magnitude of that voltage and the polarity of that voltage tells me, once I calibrate this thing, tells me exactly how strong that magnetic field is and whether or not it's a north pole or a south pole of a magnet that's doing it. So that Hall effect device is very handy. And so you can buy a number of meters with Hall effect devices, and they're quite linear up to something like 100 kilohertz. So that magnetic field doesn't have to be a 60 cycle or a 400 cycle transformer. It could be my inverter, my toroid transformer of my voltage inverter. That's taking 12 volts and stepping it up to 120 volts and doing it at 10 kilohertz, so to speak. And the Hall effect device with a good oscilloscope between 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock will show me the exact waveform of the magnetic field that the Hall effect device is seeing. You own a Gauss meter, John, and I'm pretty sure that probe on it is probably a Hall effect device. They come in all kinds of sizes and sensitivities, but they're very effective. And so measuring magnetic field is quite a bit easier in some cases than to measure an electrostatic field. But there are times when you want to measure both. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WQ?
Go ahead, Glenn. I bet you've heard these Hall effect devices, and I bet you can add some better diagram from what I just gave you. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, very good, Dick. It's just, unfortunately, the reason I jumped in wasn't even to answer that. It's just I know that you really love looking at the nighttime sky, and really appreciate that, and I just happened to walk out and take a peek at the, this is really spectacular, Dick. It's a little bit more than half covered, and it's just starting to turn red. I don't know if you have a chance to sneak out or if you have a window where you can peek out and take a look, but if you can, really worthwhile. I'll get back to you at Hall effect devices later. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, very fine, Glenn. Glenn knows that I love astronomy. And for a while, I was a member of the Astronomical Society of Long Island. I still go to their meetings. That moon is a good thing to look at. And this particular full eclipse of the moon is you're not going to see it again for something like 50 years at this magnitude of size of moon and degree of penumbra and umbra and so on, the amount of darkening. And the redness that you see is sunset. When you look at the sun setting at sunset, you're looking at the sun's rays going through a very large amount of air at a grazing angle. Air is getting scattered by the sunlight, which is essentially white, is being scattered by all those individual air molecules. That's what makes the sky look blue. It scatters blue faster than it scatters red. And so when you look through a very grazing angle, a whole lot of air, the blue gets scattered away and everything that's left is red. So at a grazing angle, our atmosphere is red. That's why sunset looks red. So all of the light hitting the moon right now, let me drop. All that light is looking at the parade. perimeter of the air mass around this planet. And the sun is being completely blocked out by the body of the Earth, but the atmosphere is deflecting some of those sun rays through a very large amount of air at a grazing angle. Red is what's left, sunset. You're looking at a very deep sunset amount of light from the Earth hitting the moon. That's why it's got that blood red color to it. Exciting thing to look at. I'm back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2IW the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. I know Paul is in there. It's 10 o'clock already. You think we got time for one more?
Yes, we do. Go for one more. These are goodies.
Okay, this one was written to me. A fellow read a new issue, and he was reading the article The Doctor Is In, describing, if you've read that, I believe you have, two antennas, and I think he was using two 23 microhenry coils in one antenna. That's the dipole with the, in the center of each dipole. Then he had basically the same antenna, the same length, with only one of those coils in the center, and it was fed from the center. His question is, was that article trying to describe that both antennas basically are equal in that in those configurations and perform relatively the same? Is that what was going on in that article? Because he didn't completely understand it. Back to you, Dick. Maybe you can help him out. KC2WGB.
Yeah, that article, which is a monthly column, The Doctor Is In, is quite good. But when it comes to dipoles, simple sounding subject ain't so simple. Every dipole is really a pair of monopole antennas back to back. Remember I gave you that example, you can put a sheet of metal in the middle of a dipole, it doesn't do anything, and you can decide to use only one half the dipole against that sheet of metal. You get half the resistance, the 73 ohms goes down to 37 ohms. But everything else behaves the same. Bandwidth, pattern, gain, all of that. You could say the other half of the dipole is now showing up as a mirror image in the great big sheet of metal. By way of the Brown and Woodward curves, you'll find out that whenever you make your monopole, Brown and Woodward, by the way, are curves of a monopole. And if you're trying to solve the problem of a dipole, you take all the numbers you read off the Brown and Woodward curves and double them. The reactance number you double and the resistance number you double when you build a dipole, because their measurements were a monopole and a dipole is a pair of them back to back. So the Brown and Woodward curves will tell you exactly what reactance you're going to get if you make the dipole too short or too long to be resonant. And as you make it too short or too long, the resistive component changes slowly. That's what the first set of curves, the resistive curves, will show you. A fairly slow change of resistance. The reactance curves will show you that the reactance in general changes very fast. So resonance really means getting rid of that reactance, because it really wreaks havoc with standing wave ratio and making the transmitter unhappy. So once you've decided you're going to make a compact antenna, there are a zillion ways you can make a compact antenna. Curving the ends down, putting top hat capacitors at the end, putting inductors anywhere you desire along the length. You choose the right inductor for your length of antenna, you can bring it back into resonance. And you can go all the way to the other extreme of moving the inductor closer and closer to the center, and finally it becomes one inductor across the two feed points of the center of the dipole. And so, if the dipole is too short, it's a capacitance, choose the right value of inductor across the feed point, and you'll get rid of the capacitive reactance. Let me drop. You could have gotten rid of the capacitive reactance directly by putting the inductor in series with the two halves of the dipole. But mechanically, that's difficult. Mechanically, it's very easy to hang an inductor across the two feed points. That's the good news. The bad news is that when you hang the inductor there, it changes the capacitive reactance. That's the good news. The bad news is it has a little bit of reactance to the, a little bit of reaction to the resistance. The resistance will change as you do that. But that's not a showstopper. because the resistance changes, you can readjust the length, readjust the value of the inductor, and get the resistance to be any value you want. As you change the length of a dipole, you can make the resistive component